Yeah.
They're not separate.
So we keep working on dealing with all these issues together as we move forward. And I want to thank you, Stan, for taking the time to give this really awesome information on beavers and Oregon and the great work that you and everyone who's involved in this are doing. And we'll keep our ear to the ground on this and supporting y'all. And I just want to say thanks for this insightful conversation.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate the Coast Range Association's effort to reach out to the public and inform. Grateful for the opportunity to speak with you.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we'll speak to Flashpoints contributor Franz Jerome about U.S. plans for a so-called humanitarian intervention to save Haiti. Can you imagine that? Also, bankkillerdrones.org begs you, yes, that's what I said, begs the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to call on all sides in the Ukraine war to immediately cease from using weaponized drones. And we'll rebroadcast this week's edition of the Election Crimes Bulletin with legendary attorney C.K. Hoffler, chair of the National Board of the Rainbow Push Coalition, and Jesse Jackson's personal attorney. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles. Here in the KPFA Bay Area, we're on KPFA, the People's Radio. And we are really happy and grateful to welcome our first guest, Nick Moturn. And he's the co-coordinator of bankillerdrones.org. That anti-war group is now emphasizing and terrified about the escalation of the drone war in Ukraine. And I know that Ban Killer Drones has been watching what's been going on in terms of U.S. drones and the dangers of drones globally. Nick, welcome back to Flashpoints. I think you've been here before. And tell us, you're saying, and I'm looking at the language very carefully. I consider myself a poet. You're using begs. I assume when you say begs the UN Secretary General, that's the word you mean? Is this prayerful?
Yeah, it's exactly the word we mean, because we have had a postcard campaign for an international treaty to ban killer drones. We sent probably hundreds of postcards to the UN Secretary General. We haven't gotten any response. We'll continue our postcard campaign, but we're in a situation now where drones are not a sideshow to war, really. They are probably the weapon that is the most likely to keep war going, as it did in Afghanistan, and to spread war. Certainly, this is happening in Ethiopia right now, a place where the United States is not directly involved with drone warfare. And we see this, I think, most frightening way to people in Ukraine. And I think it's really important to realize, too, that these drones of any kind with weapons on them are a weapon of terror, as much as they are a weapon of destroying a specific target. And this is something, and it's a new technology. It's been sold to the American people as a cleaner, nicer way of killing people, without, of course, saying that the people we've been using this on are exclusively people of color. And now this technology that has been presented as such a fine wonder of technology is coming into a war among white people, threatening to endanger Europeans. Many of us in this country have a European heritage. And so now suddenly there's attention to it that wasn't there before. And we're hoping this will cause the world population to say that this technology has to be put back in the box, that it's just too dangerous.
Let me just jump in here for a moment. You know, it's so interesting when you hear a different interpretation of drones. When you hear U.S. And Western advisors sort of referring to the kamikaze drones and their how they are inaccurate, it's sort of like you get the feeling that American drones are accurate. You know, we kill the people that we want to kill. Is there, I know there's a lot of drone usage, for instance, in the Gaza Strip, where people are locked down 24 hours a day. Drone warfare has become a regular part of invasions that Israel does into the Gaza Strip, as they call every once in a while to sort of mow the lawn and keep people in line. But tell us, are these different kinds of drones? Do we have more accurate drones here in America?
Well, it's a very good question, and I think it would help to make a definition between these kamikaze drones and drones that are intended to be like a jet fighter that goes out and attacks and then returns to its base to be reloaded. The drones right now that are being most widely used by the Russians are drones that are on a one-way mission. The thing they have in common with drones that are on a round trip missions are that they do have optical capability. They do have cameras, so that the people controlling them can pick out the target and fire at the time that's opportune. So this particular drone that's said to be from Iran, called a Shahed-136. The Russians call them Geron-2, which I guess is short for Geranium-2. These are drones that have a wingspan of a little over 6 feet. They're a delta wing. They're a triangular shaped airplane. It has rudders on each corner of the of two of the wings. They're propelled by a gasoline-powered motor. They weigh about 400 pounds, and they carry explosives in their nose as well as optical cameras. So they can be flown to an area the operator can see the target, and then they can crash the drone into the target. These drones are very inexpensive relative to other types of larger drones. They're said to cost about $20,000 a piece. Just one Hellfire missile for the other kind of drone, the U.S. has the round trip drones, just one Hellfire missile costs $150,000. So these smaller, you know, Russian Garand 2 drones will only travel about 115 miles an hour. They can go at a very low level. They can evade many air defense systems. And they're something that can travel, some people, you know, estimate as much as 1,500 miles. So they have a lot of loitering, as they say, a lot of time to circle and search for targets. Are they accurate? Probably no more accurate than a Hellfire missile fired into a building or a crowd of people. And we have this impression in the United States that our very large, much larger Reaper drones, ones that have a wingspan of 66 or 72 feet, like a small, you know, medium-sized airplane, 36 feet long, can carry two 500-pound bombs and four Hellfire missiles. It's said that these are very accurate, but if we look at the history of them, we find that, you know, there's evidence that at least 90% of the people who have been killed may not even be the people who were targeted. The Hellfire missile is made for use against vehicles, buildings, and so when it's fired into an area with a group of people, many, many people die, in addition to maybe one or two people who are targeted.
Did I just hear you say that essentially that these advanced missiles miss their target 90% of the time?
Yes, there was one study that was done by the government that was released that showed that only 10% of the people targeted were the ones who were killed. And so many people will probably remember that at the end of August of last year, the U.S. attacked a supposed terrorist in Kabul, Afghanistan, as we were departing. The U.S. was departing, and right. They killed 10 people, 7 of them children, and even the person who was targeted. It was a huge mistake. It took the government at least two months to acknowledge that this was a mistake. Right now, we're trying to raise money for a man who was severely injured in a car under attack by a U.S. drone. The missile killed 4 of his cousins, beheading one of them. So he saw all this. He was severely injured. He hasn't recovered fully. We've raised money with the help of Reprieve to try to assist him and his family getting operations. This is something that's gone on.
And just to be clear, that was a U.S. drone that took the head off of his friend. And I just want to come back when the first situation about killing the family of 7. I just wanted people to understand. I believe this was somebody who was working for an NGO or an American agency, and I believe his job was he was a water carrier. So the assassination of the family, they were targeting a water carrier.
Well,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, he was carrying water for his family, but his job with it, with this organization, the California based organization, was to advise on nutritional agricultural issues. He was a an Afghan citizen hired by this private organization to assist Afghan people with their food needs, and yet for reasons unknown he was identified as a terrorist. And we've never been able to get from the government a complete story about how did this happen, how high up the chain of command the order was given to kill this, these 10 people, seven of whom were children.
Has the U.S. apologized?
Not in any significant way. They have.
They certainly haven't accepted the blame.
They've just said we made a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so when it comes down to precision of drone attacks, the United States has absolutely no ground to stand on claiming that, you know, Russian drones are more dangerous or more imprecise or anything else. These are weapons that are subject to vast technological limitations and extremely dangerous. And you have a situation where in Afghanistan and in Yemen and other places where these attacks have occurred, people are often very afraid even now to go outdoors. There's evidence of PTSD among drone victims, particularly in a study done in Yemen. We have to realize that U.S. drones alone have killed more than 10,000 people in Afghanistan, and that's without looking at Syria, Iraq.
So they killed more than 10,000 people, and you're saying that and only 10% of these drones even found their target.
That's conceivable. That's right.
It's unbelievable. I'm sorry. These are statistics that just don't exist in, I don't know, MSDNC or whatever you listen to or watch.
No, it's taken largely from the standpoint of the people shooting the drones rather than the people on the receiving end. And as I said, this is a technology that has grown, been perfected, and spread in the use of against people of color in Middle East, Eastern Asia, and Africa. Even now, right now in Africa, at this moment, the United States is undertaking drone attacks against Al-Shabaab in Somalia at the same time that Somalia is facing a famine. And this is considered to be all well and good. And so when we're talking about what's going on in Ukraine, what we see is a different type of drone that is spreading war and threatens to spread war into other countries, more into Russia. And the Ukrainians have requested the type of drones that we've used around the world, the Reaper drone and the Gray Eagle drone. They want to have those to be used in this particular war. And there was an op-ed by George Will last week, where he's advocating for us to have these type of drones introduced, which are used not only for attacking buildings and tanks and whatever, but traditionally for assassination. And so this is an extremely dangerous kind of ramp up that's going on right now. And the U.S. is being called on to, we'll send air defense missiles, we'll help the Ukrainians we'll send more smaller kamikaze drones to them. So it's not helping anything except spread the war.
Unbelievable. Listen, we're going to have to leave it right there. Nick Moturn, he's co-coordinator with BanKillerDrones.org. And on their press release, he is saying they are begging the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to call on all sides in the Ukraine war to immediately stop using weaponized drones. Well, Nick, thank you. Say hello to Kathy Kelly for us, and please keep us posted on this. This is a profoundly, and this is really the future of warfare, unmanned warfare, and it's absolutely terrifying to imagine where we're going. Be safe, Nick. Talk
to you
soon.
Thank you for reporting. We really appreciate your report, Dennis. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Ferenczi. We're going to take a short musical break, and we're going to turn our attention to the nightmare that the Haitian people are facing, largely because the United States government has been subverting, overturning, undermining the Haitian will of the people for self-determination. It's a sickening situation, and we'll never stop covering it. This is another one the United States should hide in shame about. We'll be back. Flashpoints Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We turn our attention back to Haiti. I think Haiti is one of the first stories we ever did, Franz Jerome, on Flashpoints 35 years ago, and we've been doing it ever since. Welcome back to Flashpoints. We're speaking with Franz Jerome. He is our special correspondent on Haiti. He is a political analyst, Haitian historian, and we love to have him on to hear the real dope about what's going on the ground in Haiti. Franz, welcome back to Flashpoints.
I'm happy to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. We're here in the we're seeing the red, white, and blue, and we're hearing about, maybe Washington thinks it's time they're going to go send in the Marines to Haiti and save the day again. I guess you wouldn't like to see the Marines on the ground in Haiti, would you?
Well, as you know, I usually like to echo the voice of the majority of Haitians, the voices that I hear inside the country. And they definitely don't want to see an intervention. That doesn't mean that I hear all of the people, because there are people who are really suffering from this situation. You have parents who are seeing their daughters raped, etc., etc. But that's another story. It's the mistrust of the Haitian population that is the story, because they said that in 1994 there was supposed to be an intervention to control the army that had killed 5,000 people. And there are attaches that were the FRAP organization, that was a gang at the time, that was hideously killing Haitians. And they see that the American army came in, gathered a lot of documents from the military files of the military in Haiti, took those responsible for the coup of 1991 out of the country. And even when the government of Haiti was trying to have them extradited back to Haiti, for example, in the one of the most notorious criminals, Sweet Mickey or Michel Francois, who was a military man who had killed a lot of people, the American government intervened and made sure that the Honduran government, the government of Honduras that wanted to send him back, wasn't able to do so. And then at one point they moved him to Panama, and so he had been protected. Toto Constant lived in Queens, New York for a long time after he had been clearly identified as one of the most hideous criminals of between 91 and 94. And when he went to jail, it wasn't for anything he did in Haiti. He went to jail for violating, some ethical clauses of the real estate guidelines. He was put in jail. He wasn't put in jail for his crimes that he committed in Haiti. So the Haitian people see that. And then in 2004, they see what happened. So they see the cholera epidemic and the fact that the United Nations never took responsibility for the cholera epidemic. But most importantly, they know that since 2004, the core group has taken over the state apparatus of Haiti, replaced them at one point by NGOs, etc., etc. And these are the people that have been in control since 2004. So the Haitian people are saying, if they are coming to do the same thing that they did in the past, we don't need them. That's what the Haitian people are saying. So I am clearly echoing that side of the conversation, because we know that those who are benefiting from the situation are always going to say, please send in the troops to protect us from gangs that we have created originally to terrorize the people, but those gangs are becoming, are acting on their own, maybe, we don't know. But so we feel threatened, so send in troops. So that's
We're speaking with Franz Jerome. He's a political analyst, Haitian historian, and he's sometimes contributed to this Flashpoint show. We're always happy to have you on, Franz. It so happens I happened to be in Haiti when Aristide returned in 94. And the thing that I learned, being a novice on the subject, but really wanting to see what was going on and seizing that moment, what I learned as I walked through Cité Soleil with President Aristide and thousands of no protection, no security, no nothing. He just walked through Cité Soleil and the joy and the celebration of sort of that connection. This is a leader that their people selected. It seemed like he was sort of a popular guy, but he wasn't popular with the United States government. So the United States, I don't know, am I simplifying this too much? It simply destabilized Haiti forever and ever?
No, you're not simplifying it too much. Because in reality, if you see what happened after 2004, is that the core group, I'm talking about the U.S., Canada, France, and the European Union, OAS, they all said that they were going to transform Haiti, and they promoted governments like Michel Martelly and Jovenel Moïse at the helm of the country. And what they have done is a systematic transformation of the Haitian economy, where now it is being controlled by a few oligarchs. And those oligarchs are the ones, by the way, and I'm going to focus only on one aspect of the economy, the fact that they own the ports in Haiti. So they have privatized the ports, but in the process of privatizing the ports, they have privatized customs for all intents and purposes. Therefore, the transportation of guns to the gangs comes through those ports. The illicit drugs trafficking that they talk about comes through these ports, these privatized ports. And I use the word privatized because we've always been told since 1991, when President Aristide wanted to create a different type of economy in Haiti, no, you have to privatize all state institutions, etc., etc. That is the result that we have today. And I'm only focusing on the ports. I could also focus on the fact that they privatize the fuel distribution in Haiti, and now they are pretending that because there is no gas, there is an imminent crisis of cholera that's about to happen, and they have to intervene, and they want to call it a humanitarian intervention. So I guess I don't need to guess, because I know you know about low-intensity warfare. This is low-intensity intervention. They want to make us believe that they are going in there for humanitarian reasons, because cholera, because the gangs are blocking gas from coming, from being distributed throughout the country. Therefore, there is a danger that the water distribution is not going to be take place, etc., etc. Well, Haitians are saying that's not what they want to address. They want to address things that they have identified before. Who is bringing the guns and ammunition to the gangs? Who organized the gangs? Why did they organize the gangs? The gangs are a political instrument, and they were created by PHTK. And the international community is trying to continue with the regime of PHTK. Therefore, they are distracting people with all kind of other events and other issues, so that they can very quickly resume on their path to changing the constitution and having elections, fraudulent elections again, so that they can have PHTK continue to reign in Haiti. So the Haitian people are saying, no, we want some of the very those issues addressed systematically. So you say you are coming to stop the gangs. First thing we want to know, who organized those gangs? We know who organized them. Who gave them ammunition? We know who armed them. You know, why who? Are they using...
Who armed them? Who gave them the ammunition? Where's the... Who?
Well, PHTK. There is plenty of evidence of the systematic promotion of the gangs by the PHTK party. That is the party that's been ruling Haiti since 2010, when Mrs. Clinton went to Haiti and decided that it was best for there to be a runoff between Mrs. Maniga and Michel Martelly, who, according to the person who organized the elections at the time, Opon, who was at the helm of the committee that organized the elections, had come out fifth. So Mrs. Clinton handpicked Michel Martelly to put at the helm of the country, and ever since he's been at the helm of the country, he has systematically, since he had no political organization in the country, he had no political backup support in the country, he had to organize a force similar to his the people that he believes should control the country, the Duvalieris. So he organized a Makut organization. So the gangs are the equivalent of the Makuts of the Papadoc or François Duvalier and Baby Doc or Jean-Claude Duvalier.
Death squads.
Yes. So he, in order to remain in power, just like Papadoc, just like Baby Doc, he had to terrorize the population. He had to stop them from participating in elections. He had to stop them from participating in the economic and the political life of the country. And that's what they are trying to perpetrate in Haiti by, according to Haitians, by having this intervention. They are not going in there to change anything, to stop anybody. They are going in there to consolidate the power of Ariel Henry, who has been put at the helm of the country by a tweet made by the representative of Gutierrez in Haiti.
Can I ask you, before we're running out of time, and let me tell people, we're speaking with Franz Jerome. He's a political analyst, Haitian historian. We love having him on. Can we take a couple of minutes? What would need to happen? You know, they say Haiti's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It's not really the poorest country. It's a wealthy country. It's just being it's under attack by all the extractors and the various outside forces that come in through the Clinton types. So there's possibility here. There's big possibility. How would you run this world? This moment, what's the policy that would work for you?
Well, to me, the first thing that must happen is that they have to start sending or implementing true diplomacy when it comes to Haiti. We know that for the past 50, 100 years, all they have done in lieu of diplomacy is send agents, disrupting agents, to disrupt the normal evolution of political life in Haiti. So that's the first thing that must happen. But I believe that it's going to happen because the dynamics that's being created right now, where African countries are following very, very closely to what's happening in Haiti, is very significant. Because these African countries are, again, looking at Haiti as their future. That's what's going to happen to them, because they know the reason why it's happening to Haiti is because some people are lusting after the iridium, after the gold, after the uranium, after the silver, and after the petroleum or oil that's underneath Haiti. So they know that, and people in the Congo, throughout Africa, are very, very concerned because they see what's going on in Haiti as being very significant to them, because that's their future. If they are really destroying the all, democratic institutions in Haiti so that they can control the wealth of Haiti, then they will continue to do the same thing in Africa. And Africans, young Africans, are beginning to take a different stand. So this process, it's not only a dynamics between the core group, which is European Union, France, the United States, Canada, and the OAS, but it's also a dynamics where Haitians are moving closer and closer to African countries and African politics and African interests so that they can control their own destiny. It's the same, it's the heritage of slavery. We have to deal with it. But clearly, they want to stop the process by which we are told that we have to rely on Europe to exploit the resources that are in the ground of these countries.
All right, listen, we're gonna have to leave it right there for now, Franz Jerome. Really appreciate you taking the time out to be with us. Franz Jerome is a political analyst, Haitian historian, and a Flashpoints contributor. Thank you. Hope you're going to come back soon, because we want to keep a close eye on what the hell is going on.
I appreciate the fact that you gave me the opportunity to echo the voice of the Haitian people and say that what Haiti needs now is not a fake invasion, because they are coming to reinforce the regime that's causing all the ills to the Haitian population.
More to come, right? More to come. Thank you. Be safe, Franz.
Thank you. Enjoy.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. In one moment, we're going to play yesterday's dynamic election crimes bulletin. If you missed it, or if you heard it, you should listen to it again. We were delighted to be joined as a character in Greg Palast's new film, shall we say, but she's a civil rights icon, talking about the amazing attorney C.K. Hoffler, who has represented Greg in all the battles going on in Georgia, battling against the vote thieves. Well, she's a firecracker. She's, if you're in the Bay Area, by the way, if you are in the Bay Area, Greg Palast screening his new film tomorrow. You don't want to miss that. In fact, you're going to hear all about that right now. But you can go to kpfa.org if you're in the Bay Area. You want to check this out. It's going to be at the Grand Lake Theater tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. The Grand Lake Theater tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Vigilantes, Greg's turned his camera on the guy who wants to be the governor of Georgia, who actually was the guy who formally stole the governorship from the woman, Stacey Abrams, who he's now running against. Anyway, check out Craig's documentary tomorrow if you're in the Bay Area, 7 o'clock at the Grand Lake Theater. You can get tickets online. You can go to kpfa.org, scroll down, and you'll see the advertisement and all that stuff there. Anyway, my name is Dennis Bernstein. This is Flashpoints. Here's the Election Crimes Bulletin. And joining us is C.K. Hoffler. She is the chair of the National Board of Rainbow Push Coalition. She is a longtime attorney. She's been in the battle to save people's vote in Georgia, in Atlanta. Wow. Well, C.K. Hoffler, welcome to Flashpoints. All your skills, you've got a lifetime of skills, apparently, all sharpened for this moment. What's it look like on the ground now? You think people are going to be able to vote fairly in Georgia, in Atlanta? How's that look? What's it looking like?
Well, I don't think it's going to be easy for people to vote fairly in Georgia. And first of all, thank you for having me on the show. And the reason why I say that is because voter suppression is alive and well in Georgia. You know, Greg Palast, who is phenomenal, you all know he's phenomenal, and Vigilante really underscores in graphic detail exactly how voter suppression is manifesting itself in Georgia. And quite frankly, it's not just Georgia, it's throughout the country, but it is so specific to the voting history in Georgia, and the movie brings it to modern day voter suppression. So to answer your question succinctly, no, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for some people to vote and for us to have free and fair elections in Georgia because of the voter suppression. But by the same token, there are many, many civil rights, grassroots organizations in the field, on the ground in Georgia that are making sure that people are registered to vote. Because the key to the elections with this very, very contentious, these very contentious elections in Georgia, the key is really to register voters. This, because we are in a voter suppression state, without a question. We have very strong legislation that you all have heard this, that preclude people from even giving someone standing in line water or something to eat. So if someone has a medical condition requiring them, or water would make a difference, or if they needed a little snack, it could be, or that people who would try to tender just to the basic humanity could be arrested in Georgia. So we are confronting voter suppression on all levels, from the closing of voting stations to minimizing significantly absentee ballots to you name it. The classic voter suppression is now alive and well in Georgia. And also people challenging people's ballots. I mean, that is the most, I think, devastating aspect of what's happening in Georgia. And Vigilante, again, underscores this. So if you just imagine yourself in a situation where you haven't moved, there's no reason why your vote should be challenged. You are properly registered to vote, and someone just challenges your vote, challenges your ballot, without even you knowing the person, or without them even investigating it. That's what can happen in Georgia, and that's what is happening.
And I know that you understand, in the context of the history of the battle for the vote, particularly in the South, blood has been spilled. How do you see this historically? We thought we were sort of past this thing about people actually having the basic right to vote. Are you surprised? Where do you think the hope lies? We got a big battle ahead of us to fight for the vote.
We really do. You know, I really wasn't surprised, because ever since the 2013 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, Shelby County versus Holder, ever since that crushing opinion was inked, voting rights in states like Georgia, and actually throughout the country, have been curtailed, have been limited, have been cut, have been challenged, have been an issue, because all of the protections, the federal protections that existed, especially as related to ensuring that there be minimal or no discrimination at the polls, were stripped. And that was Shelby County versus Holder. The late, great Ruth Bader Ginsburg inked the I would say, just incredibly strong dissenting opinion in that case, and basically outlined how voter suppression, what we could expect to happen, and voter suppression. So since 2013, the states have been in control of administering the elections and did not have to report or do any of the things that they had done, had to do with preclearances previously under the law, under federal law, before Shelby County versus Holder. So what we are seeing right now in terms of voting stations being closed and the various acts of voter suppression are the direct result of that opinion. So I'm not surprised. But what is surprising is the tenacity of those who are just determined to strip away people's right to vote when we know in this country historically people died so that we, so that I might have the right to vote.
Just about 20 years ago, I was traveling around the South investigating dozens of black church burnings. You may remember there were over 100. And I remember I got to Alabama, and that's when I got my first lesson about the nature of voter suppression in the South. When Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, I learned, had made a career on stopping black people from voting. So while we were investigating the black church burnings and the Klan and all that, he was investigating why these black people kept burning their own churches and accusing other people of stopping them from voting. You ever heard stories like this?
I've had, you know, when you live in the South, I'm originally from up north, but I've lived in Georgia for a decade, and I lived in Florida prior to Georgia. And when you live in some of these states, which are very, 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 very acutely aware of the fact that when people have the right to vote, that could change the demographic, that could change the entire demographic of, or the political posture of certain counties, of certain places when they have the right to vote, and it could change who is elected, you know, there is increased voter suppression. Because if you don't allow people to vote their conscience and to vote who they feel puts forth their best interest, then you won't have the opportunity for us to see the outcome when they're free and fair elections. But if you do allow people to vote, then we see different outcomes. And in the last presidential elections, people were allowed to vote in Georgia and in many states because of COVID. You know, there were different measures that were put in place because of COVID to enable people to vote. Well, those things have been reversed. So we're expecting that voter suppression is going to be an all-time high. So none of this surprises me. In Alabama, you know, in places, Alabama, Texas, Wisconsin, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, all of these states are, there are at least 20 states in this union, maybe 22, that have very significant voter suppression laws.
Right.
And so we're just turning back the clock. And I'm reminded of people who died, who were killed so that we might have the right to vote. So it's very, very distressing. But to counter that, we are seeing groups mobilizing very aggressively in communities to ensure that people have the right to vote. You have to realize that in places like Georgia, there are communities in Georgia and rural parts of Georgia where they don't have access to the internet. So when you have people that have been illegally stripped from the voting rolls, and Greg Palast did a phenomenal job at documenting this, and there was clear evidence of this, and we had voting litigation surrounding that. When you have that, as it was the case in Georgia, where we believe prior to the presidential elections or prior to the Senate runoff race where John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock were running, close to 200,000 Georgians were illegally stricken from the roll. When you have situations like that occurring, it's imperative that people check their voting status. They have to go to votingrights.org or just check their status. But if you don't have access to the internet, forget about high-speed internet, just the internet, as is the case in rural Georgia, then you can't check that status. So that's why organizations such as, you know, Rainbow Push Coalition, Transformative Justice Coalition, the People's Agenda, Black Voters Matter Fund, and others in Georgia are critical. They play a very, very important role because they help people to register to vote. They go in those communities. They knock on the doors. They ensure that people have the option and give them the ability to check their voting status and to register to vote. That's really important. And it's not just Georgia. All of these communities in all these states in the South, you see rural communities where people don't have access to the internet, basic things. That's why, you know, during COVID, when we had, you know, children learning you know, learning virtually. Well, you have to have a computer to learn virtually. You have to have access not just to the internet, but high-speed internet to learn virtually. So that's a real problem in terms of education and voter education in some of these southern states where there's very poor or limited access to high-speed internet that would enable people to vote and to vote their conscience and to vote what they feel is best.
Beautiful. Well said. That's C.K. Hoffler. She is the chair of the National Board of the Rainbow Push Coalition. She is an attorney. She has been representing folks who are having their votes stolen. And I want to, there's a guy here on the other line. I know he's banging down the wall to get in. I think he might have some questions for you. His name is Greg Palast. He is the filmmaker of Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman. This is sort of consider this a friendly ambush. I know Greg has some questions for you as well, Greg. Join
us. It's got to be friendly because CK has acted as attorney of record for the Palace Investigative Fund. But more important, we went into federal court. And just so you know, she's not just an attorney. She is, besides Reverend Jesse Jackson's personal attorney, if I remember correctly, too, and head of Rainbow Push as the chairwoman. But she's the former president of the National Bar Association and has been, you know, at the forefront of this fight. And we went into federal court. She mentioned 198,000 Georgians wrongly removed, which, you know, as you know from the Election Crimes Bulletin, we have been, we uncovered this. We had the experts. This is all, by the way, in the film Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman. And one of the things is now with this Vigilante voter system. Maybe, and by the way, a couple things. The CK has seen the film, and by the way, appreciate the fact, CK, that according to Santita Jackson, that you were tweeting or texting her in the middle of film saying, "You got to see this girl, it's powerful."
I was.
Okay, great. So she didn't make that one up.
She didn't make it up. I was in the middle. I couldn't believe it. It was, first of all, you know, Greg, you are phenomenal. And I don't know if people completely appreciate your brilliance and what you have done in uncovering this voter suppression, especially in Georgia. But it's not just limited to Georgia. Yes. You could pick any state in the union and you would see
that's right.
You would see a replica of this type of voter suppression. It's just the evidence is baffling in Georgia. And you have and I think what was so unique about your movie, about this movie Vigilante, was that you had actual people who had been victims and who are victims today, as we speak, of voter suppression. People who had been stricken from those roles or whose ballot had been challenged by people who knew nothing about them, didn't know anything about them. They just got a list, a random list, of course, put in front of them by people who nefarious groups or groups that are there designed to win the Senate seat in Georgia by any means necessary. And then there are people that were just challenging the ballots. And when these people were confronted with the people whose ballots they were challenging, the vote they were challenging, they basically had nothing to say. They were just making up stuff as they went along. And I think the way that you juxtaposed the actual people who were victims with the people who were the perpetrators of this voter suppression was nothing short of brilliant. And then, of course, to expose and to have the country understand the history of Brian Kemp and his family and being the family who brought slavery to the state of Georgia, you know, it was also something that was masterfully done. And I think everyone needs to see this movie. It's not just about Georgia, but it's relevant.
Say that again now. Say that again. The guy who's running against Stacey Abrams, what's his connection?
His family. And Greg, you can say it, but his family was the family that brought slavery to Georgia, to the state of Georgia. His family. Now, you know, you can't rewrite history. You can change your last name, but you can't rewrite history. And what this movie does, what Vigilante does, it traces his family. Now, these are just things that are facts that are. I don't believe they're in dispute. So I think that this movie is very rich with historical significance. It's rich with the present day voter suppression. It's rich with concrete examples of how voter suppression actually manifests itself in this country, using Georgia as an example. But please mark my words, it is not unique to Georgia. This is happening throughout this nation.
Yeah,
so that's why everybody needs to see this.
Thank you, CK. And by the way, it is a movie. It's not just good for you information. It's not a textbook. It is a movie.
It is.
I was just watching it today with George DiCaprio, who is the executive producer. And it's, you know, it's weirdly, it's harsh, but it's entertaining, and there's a lot of humor. But one of the things that you brought up, CK, is that, yes, it's Georgia, but it is every state is whatever is tested out by the GOP in Georgia. And by the way, I'm not being partisan by saying that all 88 vigilante vote challengers with a quarter million challenges to voters, all 88 are Republican officials. And and overwhelmingly the people that they are attacking and that you meet in the film are African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and young people. And they're not, you know, basically they're going at the voters of color, the color being blue. It's not partisan. This is just factual. And
right.
At the beginning of the film, it's introduced by Martin Sheen. And he explains it's coming, just like the film. He says it's coming to a state near you. Bloomberg just reported that the Georgia vigilante voter challenge system has now moved to 9 other states: Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and of course Arizona. And if you might recognize that, is those are the states that are going to swing the U.S. Senate. So they take this method that they used in Georgia, and that C.K. Hoffler and Rainbow Push have been fighting, and they're taking it on the road. I mean, it could determine. Remember that Biden won Wisconsin officially by just 10,000 votes. The people that are funding the challenge in Georgia are Wisconsin billionaires, which we show in the film. Wisconsin billionaires, the Bradley family, and they are using it in Wisconsin, where, you know, again, Biden just won by 10,000 votes. Mandela Barnes, the lieutenant governor, and of course he's African American, and his constituents are facing these purges and attacks. Everything you see in Georgia is happening in Milwaukee, which is, by the way, why Milwaukee State Senator Lena Taylor in Milwaukee is having a showing of the film in Milwaukee on Saturday, because she says, it says Atlanta, but it sure looks like Milwaukee when we're looking at what they're doing.
All right, listen, everybody. We're just about out of time, and what an honor to have you with us, C.K. Hoffler, and the incredible work you do as chair of the National Board of Rainbow Push Coalition, as Jesse Jackson, my hero, working with Jesse Jackson and being his attorney. It's an honor to have you with us. We hope you win this battle with the help of Greg Palast against voter suppression. I hope you'll come back and keep us posted on the frontline battle for the vote in Georgia. Really would love to have you come back and talk to us again.
Absolutely. I'd love to come. And anytime I cannot express to your listeners how important it is to see vigilante. I cannot express how important it is, because it will open your eyes to things that we just don't want to see. It's going to make you feel uncomfortable, but it's also very entertaining. I mean, there are topics in there and situations that will move you, but also Greg has a unique way of putting together a movie that also has humor. And sometimes you laugh to keep from crying. Let's just say it. But it's a great movie. It's entertaining. It's filled with historical significance and legal significance and relevance to today's environment. So I hope that everybody will see it and also vote. You know, having the right to vote is not a partisan issue. Everyone should have the right to vote. It doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, Republican. Just let people vote. What's the big deal? And I think that is when you see voter suppression, it makes you feel some kind of way, because if you let people just vote, that is the American way. That is democracy. That's what it is to be, I believe, in this country. Anything short of that is voter suppression and designed to take us back to one of the dark eras in our country that we do not want to revisit. And that's where we're headed if we're not very careful.
Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
Now.
Bye-bye.
That wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of